I'm Patrick Henningsen. I'm a founder of 21stCenturyWire.com. It's a news analysis website. I've been going since about that website since late 2009. And I've been working with an independent organization called UK Column since about 2012. And kind of a journeyman. I've done a little bit of work or contributor for a number of other outlets over the years, including RT International, which a lot of people know, and many others. So I fell into journalism really out of blogging, actually, and I fell into blogging from activism, specifically anti-war activism. So this kind of alternative career path, if you will, if you want to call it that. It's not really been a career for most of the journey, but it's been more like just trying to make ends meet and survive. But it's out of the Iraq war, out of the situation in Palestine in the late 90s, the Yugoslavian war, that's piqued my interest, got me into anti-war activism to the point where I'm involved in documentary films and helping with this, doing that, and meeting people. And next thing I know, I was doing a lot more blogging, and the blogging turned into doing articles on a lot of websites like Global Research, Infowars.com, and so forth. And then, yeah, this things just kind of slowly evolved. The whole process probably took about 10 years.
The main thing here is really the anti-war movement hasn't stopped the wars, has it? And in fact, we've got more wars going on now. Much as though we can pat ourselves on the back as much as we want, but we haven't really managed to stop anything much, I don't think. But anyway, so just looking at the moment, the wars seem to be coming home a lot. We've got arrests here in Bristol this week of actual organisers of the Palestine movement rather than direct activists. This is where the police are going in for phishing operations, this kind of thing, getting loads of communications from these people, then using them potentially for more arrests, something you said, and a private message. And you do wonder, actually, whether the NSA, GCHQ, the Unit 8200 have been watching and reading all this stuff, and they just pick out who they want to arrest. But anyway, the point is, you and I both covered a lot of stuff to do with the 9/11 attacks, the 7/7 London bombings. And we're now looking at the Israelis penetrating the British state, basically turning Britain into a police state. Now, they keep warning about Hamas is going to destroy the world, but they seem to be doing it, here as well as there. So can you just put what's going on today in context a bit from what we now know about the 9/11 attacks on the US in 2001 and the July the 7th bombings in 2005 in London, where I think 3,000 people died in 9/11 and 56 in London.
Sure. I mean, I think we can have an in-depth discussion on 7/7, and I assume we are going to do that because it's around the 20th anniversary was this year. So let's just we can mark that on the calendar as a significant watershed moment. I think post 9/11 for Britain, it sort of solidified British consensus buy-in into the global war on terror, and there's other reasons. I think it certainly saved Tony Blair at the time. I would think in terms of opinion polls and popularity and the viability of New Labour. So for that reason, it was also important. But more than that, geostrategically, these types of events, whether they're in the United States, whether they're in Britain, whether they're in Europe with the Bataclan Theater in Paris, for instance, or the Charlie Hebdo attacks, it does help to sort of create the raison d'etre, if you will, of the message that Israel is giving to Western powers, i.e. we are your outpost in the Middle East. We have the greatest intelligence agency in the world, and we will help you defeat these Muslim terrorists, basically. And
yeah, well, hang on, because this is certainly something which is a narrative which has been going on for many years around that time. The Islamist terrorists, the dangerous Muslims everywhere, and in the States and in London, these events were but kind of turned it from something which was worried about and fussed about on the mainstream press into making the terror real. But having said that, it's something I think interesting that happened between the two events was the Iraq war. And it's like the people don't buy it, Patrick. That even despite all this stuff, we had the massive, it was nearly 3 million people turned out on the streets against the Iraq war. So they weren't really buying into this. And it's almost like this is something which has been cooked up by the press. Then suddenly these events are taking place. And I think it'd be interesting to run through some of the reasons why both you and I and anybody who bothers to look into it can see that these events were not necessarily as they were spun at all. And many of the public, I think, could see through that, particularly on, shall we say, like council estates here in Bristol. This is the sort of stuff I'm hearing.
Yeah, these events, Tony, especially 7/7, it disciplines the public. That's a term someone, an Arabic person, told me recently. He's used that term to discipline the public. They do to get the press, get the public in line with the agenda, with the foreign policy agenda, the whole thing. And you need these seminal events, these major upheavals, if you will, these traumatic things for the national living memory. Certainly that's what 9/11 was in the United States, and then in Britain it's 7/7, and then other countries have their other version of this, and so it sort of puts the country on a certain track. And no matter what, people will say, remember 7/7. Oh, we'll never forget 7/7. That's why we have troops in Afghanistan. That was a very unpopular war, by the way, as well as Iraq. So we have to consider that. All of these things move towards the same objective, which is to establish Western or NATO presence in the Middle East, Central Asia, and in North Africa a few years later with Libya, and then the other interventions that have since followed that. And now Iran is thrown into that mix as well. So U.S. occupation of Syria, all the destabilization efforts by Britain, U.S., NATO, it's all part of the same line of thinking from the Western foreign policy. So they are really important, but they need to stick. That's the thing. They need to stick. And I just find, and we can talk about, there's always common anomalies between these types of events. It's certainly from my research in the United States with not just 9/11, but other events where they coincided with, for instance, a major interagency drill, a terror drill in some cases. So that certainly was the case with 9/11. Certainly was the case with 7/7, and I can give other examples as well, including
mass shootings. So how does that work? Is the idea that some people are in the middle of conducting a drill and suddenly they don't realize it, but actually real bombs are going off?
Yeah. I mean, the benefit of running a drill parallel is if there are people in the security services listening, or the police and so forth, the chatter, the system will be flooded with chatter from the drill. Or if something does go off, they'll say, well, it's just part of that drill. We already have pre-authorization for that. We know about that drill. And so with all of these different drills going on in America, you have all these active shooter drills going on. You have all these anti-terror drills going on these days. This is all part of the post 9/11, kind of reality. And so it's same in Britain. And that was also happening. And we actually have a real live example of that, probably the best ever example of this for the 7/7 bombings. That is just quite improbable. In fact, unbelievable. And if you think it's a coincidence, and you can go into it, Tony, because I know you have chronicled this really well. If you think this is a coincidence, well, I don't know what to say.
Well, it's a six. I sat and worked it out. You know, an exercise at the same three tube stations where the actual bombs went off is around about a 6 billion to 1 at the same time possibility that Peter Power was not lying, he wasn't lying. So it's so he was lying basically when he said that there was no I can also remember though the soundtrack of the from NORAD and the US air defense radar people saying on 9/11, is this real world or is it exercise? So one must assume that the actual real radars are being hacked and they're being told an exercise is going on, but they're not sure if they're part of it or not. This obviously seeds massive confusion. It's impossible for any kind of air defense system to react in that circumstance.
Not only that, Tony, but if, and I obviously we would have been called a crazy conspiracy theorist for even saying what I'm about to say right now, maybe if we said this 15 or 20 years ago. But now when you understand the level of penetration that some countries' intelligence services have into other countries, if we just look at the Lebanese pager attack that Israel waged not so long ago, and that just shows you how deep the penetration is into other aspects, technical aspects, into police services, into foreign intelligence services. So let's say, for instance, that a U.S. agency was running a drill, or a U.S. agency is running a cell of terrorists that are being managed by an informant, and so forth. And then if there was, let's say, I'll give you an example, let's say there was an Israeli espionage operation going on U.S. soil. This is not a far-fetched scenario, because there have been multiple Israeli spy rings busted by the United States, by the FBI over the years. There have been multiple spies arrested, indicted, and imprisoned in America from Israel. So this isn't a far-fetched scenario. And so think about that. If you have that level of penetration and you're running a drill concurrently, if that drill is infiltrated on any level, the level of confusion as to what's real and what's not could cause a somewhat state of paralysis for law enforcement. And the security mechanisms that are there to prevent such things would basically be gummed up. And then you have an event, and then the press start moving, and then the political juggernauts begin, and the thing has already taken on a life of its own. And there's very few people that have the wherewithal politically to push back against all of that. And I think, personally, I think that's what happened on some of these events, including 7/7. I will even go further, Tony, and I know you could probably chime in on this, because it's important that the four bombers, the alleged bombers, Mohammed Sadiq Khan, Shehzad Tanweer, Jermaine Lindsay, Hasib Hussein, they may have been unknowingly taking part in a drill at some point, realized that this was the case or not, who knows. But certainly, if we look at the evidence, and I know you've looked at this closely, to say, look at the behavior, look at the forensic evidence we do have, and the profiles of these young men, it doesn't add up in terms of the official story. It just simply doesn't.
Yeah. So I mean, I got a call after we did the Martin Summers and I did the I think it was in 2008, after the London bombings, BBC Conspiracy Files program. Produced by Tristan Quinn, which was an hour-long look at it all, at what had happened. And, you know, basically, during that program, we explained there's a long history of NATO intelligence services blowing up people in Europe and blaming it on, in the old days, the Soviet Union. This is Operation Gladio. And this is the first many, you know, even the ex-MI5 people, David Shaler and Annie Machon, had ever heard of Operation Gladio. Nobody knew about it. It was so supposed to be so secret. And so the way that the BBC spun everything in the Conspiracy Files program was they spun us as a sort of dangerous people, you know, who were talking to the Muslims. And actually what was happening is, of course, the Muslim community in Britain was talking to itself and saying, actually, and pointing out where journalists were prepared to listen, and some were, that, for example, at Finsbury Park, they had an Al-Majarun cell, which was being run by MI5, although they didn't know it at the time, which was an Islamist group linked to Al-Qaeda, linked to Operation Cyclone back in the 1980s. And the Muslims themselves in Finsbury Park Mosque were saying, can you please come into the police? Please do something about these people. They're nutters. But nothing was done up until, of course, the terror exercise itself. So, you know, some, I think, useful information was gotten out through the BBC, but it was clear that we were pushing against, well, swimming against the tide, because there was this particularly anti-Muslim thing going on. So anyway, I wonder what links you can make to the Israelis, because we're now looking at a very great deal of Israeli influence here in Britain. Basically, Britain is part of a genocide going on against the Palestinians in a state that we created, by the way, back in 1948. Essentially, gave them the land, got the land for them in the First World War, gave it to them in the Second World War.
I mean, I think that for me, the most interesting part about the Israeli-British relationship is the level of interference and meddling in British politics. If you saw Al Jazeera's excellent investigative, by the way, I'm not endorsing Al Jazeera's reporting on, because they're absolutely diabolical in Syria and in Iran. But on the issue of Palestine and the Israeli lobby in the United States and Britain, they do excellent work. So it was called the lobby. And there was the lobby Britain and there was a lobby America, two different documentaries on the same topic, and it really goes into great undercover work as well. It shows you how that the lobby had planned to. Well, you could see how they successfully took down Jeremy Corbyn, and basically front ran this campaign to purge the Labour Party of any what they called anti-Semitism, but was really any pro-Palestinian sentiment, quite clearly. And this was an operation that wasn't just the Israeli lobby involved in this. It was the Murdoch Press. It was the United States deep state as well. It was U.S. politicians basically said, "Oh, we won't be the usual Tony. We won't share intelligence if Corbyn is elected, and his because of his Marxist past and his Al Qaeda affiliations." And he was like, "They aligned him with every single terrorist group on the planet." And then the cenotaph, and then the Russian communist hat. They did the whole nine yards on Corbyn, and the Times ran that huge spread, basically saying, "Oh, the deep states of the U.S. and Britain won't accept the Corbyn premiership. Therefore, it's a non-starter." And that kind of made it okay to do the major takedown front ran by then by the Board of Deputies, the Israeli or the Jewish press, as it were, the Jewish Chronicle and all these other organizations just piled in. And then the Labour Party itself piled in on half their party and even expelled a whole raft of Jewish members who they claimed to be anti-Semitic. But all of that, just imagine the furor over alleged Russian interference for, 6 years in the United States, paralyzed the entire political system. But yet they found no Russian interference at the end. But you have this level of interference. So, and clearly intelligence services from Israel are deeply, deeply involved in that. And I think that was also, if not proven by the Al Jazeera documentaries, but it was implied, it's pretty obvious, it's all being run out of the Israeli embassy, which of course probably most likely has a Mossad station there, and quite active one at that.
Well, and also, I mean, we can go back to look at 7/7 a little bit. Benjamin Netanyahu, the now Prime Minister, at the time he was Finance Minister, just by coincidence, he happened to be at L in London that day, heading for Liverpool Street Station. The Associated Press contacted him from Jerusalem when the bombs went off and said, "How is our Prime Minister? Is he okay?" And Dan Shaham at the Israeli embassy reported back to Amy Teeble at the Associated Press desk in Tel Aviv that, oh, he's fine because he changed his plans because we had a warning that there was maybe something happening and a possible bomb attack today. The only thing is that wasn't shared with anybody else. Scotland Yard certainly said that nobody told us anything. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But the fact is that he was the only person in London, it seems, that knew that there were about to be a bunch of bombs go off. I think it's interesting you mentioned Shehzad Tanweer and the other four alleged bombers. Not Nafees Ahmed. Yeah, Nafees Ahmed, who'd written a book about the 7/7 London bombings, told us at the time that he was told by his publisher that he had to change all of the expressions in his book to from alleged bombers to bombers, otherwise they wouldn't publish it at the last minute. So he caved into that one. which is a bit of a pity. But anyway, I got a call after the 7/7 conspiracy party. It's one of the nice things about going on TV, even if they are trying to ridicule you on there, is that people see it and they contact you. And this guy contacted me who'd been involved in money laundering investigations. And he said, well, yeah, he said Jermaine Lindsay was a money launderer. And whatever he wasn't definitely not an extremist, or he was just a finance guy. So crooked deals were sent to him. He would sort it out. But it seemed Navy knew too much about something and it would be convenient to get rid of him. But particularly the thing which worried me about 7/7 was the appearance of this company, Verint Systems, getting a contract a couple of months before the bombings on the London Underground, which had just been privatised, to do their CCTV. And so they were every night inside the tunnels installing CCTV cables. They had access to put bombs under trains. And by the way, the evidence is overwhelming, the photographic evidence and the injuries, as well as the testimony of by Mark Honingsbaum and others, Bruce Late, etc., that the bombs were underneath the trains. And when I spoke to Mark, who's a Guardian writer who was there on the scene on 7/7, he explained to me that the article that appeared in the next day's Guardian was different to what he'd said on his little audio recording, the bombs being under the trains. He said that, well, the next day's article said the bombs are in the trains. And so I said to him, why is that? How do you explain that? And there was a long silence. And Mark said, not everything I submit as copy ends up in the next day's newspaper. So that's that anomaly explained. Some editor at The Guardian decided to change the journalist's words. And it was a company called Verint Systems, which is part of Converse, which, by the way, Carl Cameron investigated for Fox News in the United States. And they were grabbing massive amounts of telephone call information from these digital phone networks, where they were watching to see who was calling the FBI, and when someone they didn't want to call the FBI was calling the FBI, that they would make sure that some of their people inside the FBI would close the investigation down, or that if the FBI were onto the Mossad operatives running around in America, that they would change their phones. Simple as that. So they had access to all that data. So as FBI agents are trying to chase people down, they don't realise that the Mossad were one step ahead. But then, of course, with 9/11, and I'll leave you to say if you want to any more about the 9/11 attacks. But one of the most obvious things is these dancing Israelis filming the planes crashing into the World Trade Center, waving their arms around, cheering as the planes went in. How did they know? Why were they dancing as something so horrendous and horrific had happened? It seemed obvious that this was an operation that had been connected somehow to Israel.
Yes. Yeah, we published a good report on that at 21st Century Wire about, I don't know, in 2013. And that's just really going off the official court documents and what was publicly available at the time, just kind of piecing together what was clearly a very strange story. And of course, as you know, Tony, some of these individuals, at least the artists that were so-called artists that were staying in the World Trade Center doing a art installation at one of the empty floors, vacant floors up there somewhere on one of the towers within five or six individuals, I can't remember, appeared on Israeli television not long after. Telling about their experiences, almost it felt like a victory lap on some level, and it was just the most bizarre thing. And I still, to this day, nobody can give us a really straight explanation other than, well, that's just a crazy conspiracy theory. They're just a couple of Israeli artists, and they're talking about their experience during 9/11. You know, what's nothing to see here? Move along. So I guess we're not supposed to ask any further questions on that. Which is just strange, but that's kind of like how it's been treated for the longest time. I think only now, Tony, people are taking a fresh look at these things, because they're seeing what's happening around the Middle East. They're seeing what's happening in Gaza. They're seeing the double standard in terms of international law, war crimes, Geneva Convention, Genocide Convention. And they're also seeing the degree in which U.S., British, French, German governments seem to be completely under the thumb in some way, politically anyway, or at least through public pressure or the fear of being, I don't know, harangued in the press as an anti-Semite or whatever, that Israel has this incredible influence over politicians in our Western countries. And so you put these things together and then you realize, wow, there's a whole lot of evidence that was never really attended to, was never really dealt with in the wake of 9/11, as well as 7/7. And these are two really important events. They're two important events because Britain and the United States are the two most important geopolitical actors in the world. And they determine really the trajectory of geostrategic movements. They have done together for, well, Britain has done for, you know, the last almost 300 years with its allies and now with the United States since in the post-World War II era. There's no question about that. Iraq would not have been possible for the United States if Britain had not been there in order to give the Bush administration legitimacy. So they work together. It's more than a special relationship. It's a symbiotic relationship. By the same token, the last time I think anybody took a war to the House of Commons, to Parliament in any serious way, was David Cameron in August of 2013. And of course, the vote came back as a no for attacking and going to war with Syria over the alleged chemical weapons attack in East Ghouta in August 2013. But had that passed, had that vote happened under Cameron, you can be absolutely certain, you bet your bottom dollar, Barack Obama would have been in right behind him, because Americans read what Britain does as somewhat legitimate course of foreign policy, even if they concede that George Bush is a little bit of a wildcat. They'll say, well, it's okay, Tony Blair was there to temper his dark side. This is how Americans talk, by the way, I'm telling you. And this is how the press generally look at these things. If it's unilateral, it's problematic. But if it's a coalition, it's kind of okay. So this is how these things work. And I think Britain also had to be heavily invested. Its public had to invest in the global war on terror. And not only that, but to transform the internal security state, the domestic security state, and also to discipline the media as well, to make sure that they're on track and those D-notices work and everything is smooth sailing in terms of press coverage on all these strange anomalies and bizarre events that seem to pop up one after the other after 7/7. There's just a whole, you know, bevy of unlikely terrorist attacks and knifings and Islamic outbursts and things like that, always with somebody who was, quote, on the radar of the security services, that which we call a known wolf, as opposed to a lone wolf, where that's a known wolf. How many times have we seen that in any of these unlikely?
This is fascinating, isn't it? When you get to 2017, that general election, you had three alleged terror attacks. I mean, obviously, the Manchester one really was, but the question is, who put this bomb in Manchester? But then you had the London Bridge and the Westminster attacks. Looking at the record of the security services is absolutely appalling. All three apparent ringleaders of those attacks were people who, straight away, people contacted the press saying, well, I reported this guy to the anti-terror hotline, you know, a few months ago or a year ago, or... So they're all very much on the radar. And it's almost as if you report someone to the anti-terror hotline, they're likely to be the patsy for the next attack. But, of course, that 2017 election was very much around Corbyn and his credibility.
Yes.
And the idea was to really frame the election in terms of who is friendly with the terrorists. Do you really want a prime minister who's going to be... Anyway, look, back to 9/11 briefly, because one of the key things to do with that was the incredible number of people who were involved in the US state, the Project for New American Century and others, who were dual Israeli US citizens, Patrick. And it seems that it was those individuals who were charged with investigating it.
Yes, this is just an unavoidable kind of aspect of the neoconservative cadre of for the Project of a New American Century. And then we have the Clean Break document, which is something that Benjamin Netanyahu himself is basically trotting out in front of Congress. I mean, he's been lobbying in the U.S. forever, right through the 90s. His book that he wrote, a book on terrorism that came out, is just basically a roadmap of every conflict that came after that. So forget about Wesley Clark's speech at the Continental Club, where he said 7 countries in 7 years. Look at Netanyahu's book, which I think he published in 95 or 96, right around there. And basically, he's predicting 9/11, and he's saying we need to invade Iraq, and then democracy will flourish in the Middle East as soon as we take down and invade and occupy and destroy Iraq. Then, democracy will flourish. Trust me. This is, and of course, that's the opposite happened. But the neoconservative element is important because, and more details come out over time. That's the beautiful thing about history, Tony. I think it was recently John Kiriakou, who's a former CIA agent, operative, and he's been doing a lot on the podcasting circuit recently, and he's kind of been vindicated. I think it's taken a long time, but he's kind of been vindicated. And he said the Israeli intelligence and the Israeli operatives had basically, through Douglas Feith in the Pentagon, who I think was Assistant Defense Secretary at the time under Bush, they had a back door where they didn't even need to show credentials to get into the Pentagon. They had the level of access was unprecedented for Israel, and that includes into the Pentagon, into the White House, into the CIA, and so no other country enjoys that type of privilege. But the amount of intelligence they provide the United States, that to me is very debatable intelligence. In other words, they could. Kiriakou basically inferred sort of that they had this level of credibility and were, they were given deference by their American counterparts to a degree that's just unbelievable. So like whatever they say, it's gold coming out of their mouth, and whatever they put on the table, you can take it to the bank in terms of so-called intelligence. And what the Israelis have done, and if you listen to Colonel Larry Wilkerson, who is the chief of staff of Colin Powell at the time, he said that the problem with the Israelis is whatever that came out of their mouth was generally a lie. And he said all they did was lie constantly. So he didn't trust them. And he said that other people.
You know what? You're reminding me of what's been happening this week with the BBC interview with Donald Trump, where he says, do you trust Putin? Says the BBC guy. There's a long pause. And Donald Trump says, well, I trust hardly anyone. And you do wonder, to what extent the British and the United States securocrats are really running rings around these elected politicians. We've just seen this week, haven't we, Patrick, the release of this massive database by the they're saying it's the counter-terror police or the Foreign Office accidentally releasing a massive spreadsheet with all of these British agents, we now know as of today, because the super injunction has only just today been lifted. This is Thursday we're talking. But it's quite clearly they're incompetent. They're absolutely incompetent. If they are sending emails out around the world on a blind carbon copy basis of databases with their special forces soldiers, their agents, etc., on that database by mistake, then they clearly don't know what the hell they're doing. And it would be surprising if anybody would trust Britain to share data with it if they treat it in this cavalier fashion. In fact, it's very much like the Cold War. The Americans refused to send anything to Britain, refused to trust Britain at all, because they knew that Britain was thoroughly infiltrated by Soviet spies. I suppose at the time it was the Cambridge spies. But anyway, what do you make of this data breach this week? Because the intelligence services quite clearly can't do their job. They seem to have been totally taken over by a foreign power, and they are possibly the biggest threat to national security this country's ever seen.
It's disturbing. It's not the first time. And you do have these sort of stories that pop up periodically. And what it does is also, it just makes you wonder, how compromised, some of the individuals are, because then it takes on, something like this. If it's exposed, it's political currency. So it takes on a life of its own politically within the country, in this case, in Britain. And then what sort of pressure could be applied as the result of that leak, or as a result of that exposure, in terms of change of personnel, in terms of change of policy, in terms of, somebody coming to your aid. And so the Israelis coming, we've got a better secure system we want to sell you. And, you know, the wonder tech of the Tel Aviv Silicon Valley are always there at the beckoning call of the Western governments. There's the level of infiltration right back to Robert Maxwell days, of Israeli intelligence into the British state, into the French European governments, into the United States. So maybe the Americans might have more proprietary, software and so forth, but who trains all of our, first responder police, anti-terror police in America? Israelis train them. These are the firms, the Israeli-run firms, that are basically getting all the contracts.
They are. And lo and behold, techniques that they've been practicing on Palestinians, which are now being introduced to Britain. Anyway, look, we've only got about a minute left, Patrick. But finally, we often get asked this question, Britain, United States, Israel, which is the head of the snake?
I look at it as one unit. I look at, if you want to put a hierarchy together, I'll probably think, you know, Britain's the brains, America's the muscle, and Israel is the local enforcer in the Middle East. It's one unit. They work together, and their goals and objectives are absolutely harmonized. And for the U.S., it's a quid pro quo. The U.S., and I'll speak for Britain on this as well, the U.S. and Britain probably the same, they're not going to get in the way of the Greater Israel Project. So they will, the quid pro quo is, we'll let you do the Greater Israel Project, but so long as you're advancing our geopolitical and geostrategic goals, and these are long-running strategic goals by Britain and the United States that go back hundreds of years for Britain, and then more recently...
BRICS are kind of putting paid to all that. But anyway, look, Patrick Hennington, thanks ever so much for joining us.